Hello, it's the middle of the week and another busy day on the radio. I'm Louise Herity. This is Playback Daily and here's some of what's coming up.
I've had friends that are first-time parents that it's really difficult to have to go into a hospital and not really know what to expect. Like, you know, we're going in, we don't really know if I'm probably going to have to come straight back out and sit in the car for the rest of the day and to wait for a phone call, which is kind of tough, you know.
Shaving rash and razor bumps are a very common disorder that drive a lot of men mad.
My English teacher very strangely got me to stand up in class in front of all these strangers. They introduced me as a relative of Tolkien, yeah, and we'll be reading The Hobbit over this coming year. And I just thought, what's all this about?
Yeah.
Last week, the HSE issued new guidelines on COVID restrictions to maternity hospitals. This would allow partners to attend routine appointments. Now, the Rotunda in Dublin says they'll continue to impose restrictions. Mary Wilson spoke to the master of the Rotunda, Fergal Malone, on Morning Ireland. But first, reporter Una Kelly heard from partners and an expectant mother outside the hospital.
My wife is going in for a C-section this morning, so I dropped her off. She needed to be here by 7. I'll get a call back when she's ready to go into theatre. I'll meet her outside theatre. We'll be together for a little bit. She'll go in, get anaesthetic and stuff, and then we'll go in and I'll be actually physically there for the operation. I think I'll be there for recovery, and then from then on, I'll be there for visiting hours, which is like a couple hours in the morning and then 4 hours in the evening.
How do you feel about all of that?
It's not ideal, but I'm okay. But I kind of trust them that they're doing what they need to do. It doesn't bother me too much. I just take it as the reality of the way it is these days, you know.
My wife is tomorrow is her due date. Actually, today night she had the pain, so we are just going. She is in the emergency, so I'm waiting for the response from the what she are planning for admission or anything.
What do you think of not being allowed inside the hospital?
It's okay. But the very problem is the car parking is very difficult. Actually, I'm a health worker, so I know the situation. Actually, very difficult in the hospital situation. I'm working in the St. James Hospital. So due to COVID, the staff also is struggling very much.
This is our second one, so it's a little bit easier on us. But I've had friends that are first-time parents that it's really difficult to have to go into a hospital and not really know what to expect. Like, you know, we're going in, we don't really know if I'm probably going to have to come straight back out and sit in the car for the rest of the day and to wait for a phone call, which is kind of tough, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's tough with everything going on, I think.
How are you feeling about it all? Do you think it's fair enough given the situation, or what do you think?
Not really at this stage. Like, you see so many different events happening and everything else, you know, opening up, but we can't go in together to be with my partner, you know. So it is tough, you know.
It's brutal, like, you have to sit here on your own, like, you know, and then you have to just ring them, like, at this stage, everybody is nearly vaccinated anyway, so they should be lifting it. But that's my opinion.
Una Kelly reporting from outside the Rotunda this morning. Fergal Malone, master of the Rotunda, good morning. Hello, Fergal.
Good morning, Mary.
Ah, good morning. I'm hearing you loud and clear now. People are very accepting of the situation, but it is very, very difficult for them. You're going to continue to impose restrictions, but can we start by talking about what people can do at the Rotunda at the moment, pregnant women and their partners?
Well, actually, the Rotunda for quite a few months now has exceeded the HSE guidelines on what they expect to achieve for maternity services. So you're probably aware the HSE guidelines suggest 30 minutes of visiting time per day. The Rotunda actually gets all of our patients over 5, nearly 6 hours of visiting each day, and in fact 8 or 9 hours on the weekends. So we've actually done a very good job on being able to support partners of patients who've had a baby or admitted to the hospital to have much more extensive visiting than the minimum guidance from the HSE. Early scans, when people might be particularly anxious or nervous, we have a new pathway in place this week onwards that will allow partners to accompany patients into the early pregnancy assessment unit. And indeed, what people often refer to as their big scan, the anomaly scan at 20 weeks. For quite a few months now, we've managed to get a system in place that partners can be there for that. And of course, Mary, it always goes without saying that any exceptional circumstances, so for for example, if a patient is given bad news or if a patient unfortunately is facing a particularly complex situation, we always make exceptions and get partners and indeed other family members in with them. So that has been happening and continues to happen.
But so what is not happening then, and what will you continue to restrict? Yeah.
So in certain parts of the hospital, in particular the old 1757 main building, there is no ventilation, there's no air conditioning. So in certain parts of the hospital, such as the main waiting room for the emergency department, the main waiting room for the ultrasound department, there just isn't physically the space to put large numbers of adults sitting together in a confined space. For example, our main ultrasound waiting room has only 12 seats in it. Now, if I have 8 or 9 mothers sitting there, and suddenly that's 16 or 18 adults, because they all have a partner with them, in a small room that is not ventilated and not capable of being ventilated, that is a very serious risk. And it's the same with the emergency room waiting area. There's only 10 seats there. And again, if they're all filled, or most of them are filled by patients needing assessment, and I now double that by having their partner with them during that time, it's just not safe.
And if you move on to the delivery, what is being restricted around the delivery time?
So again, thankfully, every one of our delivery rooms in the rotunda is a single private delivery room. So once a patient is admitted to the delivery room, whether or not she's 1 centimetre dilated or 10 centimetres dilated, of course, the patient's partner will be with them for every minute of that journey.
But just to be clear on that, Fergal, once a woman goes into labour, is her partner with her?
Once she's in a single occupancy room, the answer is a clear yes.
And how quickly does she get into a single occupancy
and that,
room?
And that depends on the busyness of the hospital at that moment in time.
How many of those rooms do you have?
We have 8 actually at the moment, going to 11 in a month because we're in the middle of the construction at the moment. The challenge around this particular topic that you asked me about, Mary, is sometimes for induction of labour, or if someone is in the very earliest phase of labour where we're not sure if it's true labour or not, they might be, depending on the particular room available to us, might be in a 6 or a 10 person room. Now, again, that's in the old 1757 building that does not have air conditioning or ventilation. So if you have 6 mothers in a single room, and then suddenly that's to be 12 adults in a single room, in particular, if they're not vaccinated, that is a very serious risk
and
for their health and
safety. And on the vaccination, you've come up with some numbers on vaccination. Only 39% of expectant mums vaccinated, and just over 40% of their partners.
Yeah, so we make our decisions based on real-time data that's actually going on in the rotunda. So every week and we survey all of our inpatients to find out exactly what is their vaccination status. And last week, 39% of inpatients, of mothers in the rotunda hospital, were fully vaccinated, and only 41%, almost identical, of their partners were fully vaccinated. And to be honest with you, that's disappointing, but in ways, I suppose, not surprising, because there is some vaccine hesitancy. And of course, what that means, Mary, is 60% of the patients and or partners walking around the rotunda hospital today are not vaccinated, and therefore are vulnerable to COVID infection, or indeed
finally,
more likely to transmit.
If they were vaccinated, if this number rose to 70 or 80% among partners and among the expectant mums, would you change the situation?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There was a comment from one of your speakers earlier on that, sure, isn't everybody most people in the community vaccinated? And that's the common myth about maternity services. While 75 to 85% of the general population are vaccinated, that's not reflected in what's going on in maternity hospitals. If we can get that vaccination number up towards those range, absolutely, you'll see it being safe to restrict all, to relax all restrictions. Okay. So I'd encourage every single pregnant woman, please get vaccinated, and their partners.
Master of the Rotunda, Fergal Malone on Morning Ireland. Later, Ryan Tuberty spoke to the great-grandson of legendary writer J.R.R. Tolkien, whose work includes The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. Royd Tolkien chatted about his famous ancestor and went on to tell a fascinating story about his late brother's bucket list.
How did you feel about having the name that your great-grandfather had growing up and your relationship to it and what to do with it?
Wow, that's a good question you start with, isn't it? You know, it didn't really kind of figure, you know, sort of realise the length and breadth of his fame until really I was sort of a teenager. Actually, when I was 11, the first year in high school, my English teacher very strangely got me to stand up in class in front of all these strangers. They introduced me as a relative of Tolkien,
yeah.
And we'll be reading The Hobbit over this coming year. And I just thought, what's all this about?
Yeah.
So I hadn't really grasped, you know, that he was such a famous author. But you know, it's a very normal life. There isn't any extremes or...
Yes.
It's not a lavish lifestyle or anything. It's just very down-to-earth and normal. I live in Wales, North Wales, and... I don't go to sort of VIP events and stuff.
Do you not? Because I presume there's a microclimate of Tolkien Eastas who are extremists, perhaps.
Yeah, there is, more so now with the films coming out.
Yes.
Prior to that, it was obviously just the literary works, and the families had an association with a society called the Tolkien Society.
Mm.
Which has been around for as long as I have. And they have events in Oxford every year called Oxenmoots. And those are things that we used to go to just to join in the celebrations. And it was brilliant. It was loads of fun. And we would then transfer that. We had a small holdings, a mini farm in Wales.
Yeah.
And growing up, a couple of fields around it. And so we used to invite members of that Tolkien Society to camp in the fields on over a summer. And as a kid growing up, it would just be fun. It would be sword fighting, campfires, foraging for food. So I kind of, you know, the fandom was always there. Mm. It was just a gradual introduction into it. And then, of course, when the films hit, it went a lot bigger.
Yes, and we're into Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. It turned out to be quite the franchise, didn't it, Roy?
It did, yeah. Peter Jackson did, and you know, Fran and Philippa, writing partners, and all the crew over there did an unbelievable job of the films, and introduced a lot more people into Tolkien's writing, and from that, people then explored his other works.
And I don't know if you're familiar with it, but I believe that J.R.R. Tolkien, your great-grandfather, would have possibly based a little bit of Middle-earth on a place in Ireland called the Burren. I don't know if you're familiar with that at all.
I am, yes. Strangely enough now, I myself have been over to Ireland, absolutely love it. Haven't been there for many, many years.
Yeah.
Made a trip to Galway to see a friend over there and didn't realise that he'd been there as well. West Coast, I believe, of Ireland, he spent time travelling over there and walking, loved walking. I have seen that there is certain conversations going on that he took a lot of influence from particular areas of Ireland and the Burren in particular. I haven't explored too deeply into that to find out whether or not, but... It's something that I'm fascinated over, and it's actually something that, beyond what I've done, which I'm sure we'll get into, is something that I want to explore more and kind of carry on walking in his footsteps and following the routes that he took and, you know, exploring places like Ireland and Switzerland, where he also had walking holidays. And that's another thing.
That's another show. It's and another possibly another book. It'd be a lovely coffee table book or something photojournalistic book on that. Because I often thought when the movies came out, and they obviously Peter Jackson, therefore New Zealand, therefore filming in that beautiful part of the world, which I've never been to, but just from seeing it on TV and what have you, I would have thought that if we had just struck a bit gold ourselves in Ireland with the director, this country would have suited Middle Earth perfectly.
Absolutely. And there was, you know, there's Amazon are doing the TV series, and they're actually shooting over in New Zealand as well.
Okay.
But there was a point when they were scouting other locations, and I believe they did look over towards Ireland, as well as Scotland. And I think Ireland just shares a lot of that landscape that would be perfectly suited to Middle Earth.
We're roughly the same age, Royd, and with that in mind, and we both have stories about our brothers that we love and have always loved, and we would have probably had similar grown up in a similar time, childhood wise. Tell me about growing up with Mike.
Mike's my younger brother, and it was just we had an older sister, And it was just an adventure, you know, say living in Wales. It was just climbing trees, riding on bikes, making dens. But it was always Mike being the younger one. I think he just tried to kind of like beat me on multiple things. Mm. So he was always the guy that rode the bike the fastest. I could never keep up with him. He would climb the highest tree. It was always that sort of competitive spirit. But he always, pretty much majority of the time, beat me on those certain things. And I was happy with that. It was fine. I was kind of like, yeah, whatever, let him win. But yeah, lovely childhood growing up. I mean, we became a lot closer as we became adults and just started hanging out a lot more and just enjoying each other's company and just generally having a laugh, you know, great, lovely childhood, wonderful adulthood growing up with him. And just going on little adventures here and there, just enjoying stuff. Yeah.
So life was going fine, and you had a lovely, as you say, adult friendship, which doesn't often happen, but when it does, it's glorious. And if I may take you to November 2010, which is not that long ago, at the age of 35, tell me about the cramps.
Yeah, so what started was Mike was getting cramp in his left leg, and just in his calf, and it was just odd. Whenever he flexed his foot, it would cramp up, and thought nothing of it to begin with, but then it just wasn't going away. It was persistent. So he started going to the doctors and asking about it, and they inevitably started, you know, prescribing various pills and things like that, and just said it will get over it, and it just wasn't going. And then it sort of progressed, and it became in his both legs, and then other symptoms started appearing, in particular a certain symptom, which was his muscles started twitching without, you know, any fatigue or anything in his muscles. He would just be sat on the couch, and all of a sudden his thigh muscle would start twitching. Really odd. Again, went to the doctors, checked it out. They had no answers. More drugs being prescribed. And this went on, and it gradually started feeling like he was getting weaker on his legs. And this went on for a good year of not really knowing what was going on, and feeling sort of slightly feeling weaker in his legs, weaker in his hands. And we're all just kind of like quite, and Mike was as well, quite sort of blasé about it. You know, as you do, you get something and you just think, well, it'll pass. But this just wasn't, and things were getting more and more difficult. So it just, Mike then started going to various specialists and finding out, and then started sort of almost self-diagnosing what could be wrong, thinking it may be Lyme's disease or various other things. And this went on for a while. And it came to the point in 2012 where, after seeing multiple specialists, he was told it was, he was given a working diagnosis of motor neuron disease.
Okay.
And he hadn't heard of or knew about motor neuron disease. Phoned me, I was down in London at a friend's house. Phoned me, it was a Thursday, I was coming home on the Friday, and said, I've just been told what it is. I was like, yeah, what? And he was worried it might be MS. And we had a friend that went through MS, and I reassured him it wasn't that. But then when he said it was motor neuron disease, I was like, what? What's that? And he said, Google it, but don't Google it. Don't go too deep into it. And I looked at it, and I just saw all various things and websites about my genuine disease, and just world collapsed.
Isn't that the thing that I think Dr. Google is probably one of the greatest horror characters never written, because he seems to be a figure, a spectral figure who inspires fear and dread into anyone who goes near his virtual clinic.
Yeah, there's nothing good on there, is there?
Not really, which is why God created, you know, doctors who spend 7, 8, 9, 10 years studying so that you can go to them and find the real answers. And you got the answer you needed, which was, this is the diagnosis. You obviously found out what MND is. In my experience of seeing people with motor neuron disease, it is relentless and it's cruel.
Awful, indiscriminate. Mm-hmm. It can affect anyone. It's normally sort of middle-aged, older people. Mike, you know, at that age, and he passed away when he was 39, is even rarer. It's not really known about because there's nothing you can do about it. There's no treatment. There's no cure. And if you're diagnosed and you have it, there's really only one outcome. Mm. And reading all of that and finding out all that information about this disease was horrifying. It absolutely devastating on so many levels.
And this was only 6 years ago. This is your beloved brother. I'm not trying to lay it on. It's just a matter of fact. And how did you manage, or how are you managing?
I didn't manage. There was a point when Mike and I, when I came back from London, we all gathered as a family and typically didn't talk about it and just sort of thought, you know, if we bury our heads in the sand. And there was a moment then when all the family left and it was just Mike and I standing outside my house, and we just broke down and held each other. And we're close as a family. We've always been close, but we're not really that sort of huggy family that you really see that, you know, sort of hugging all the time and saying we love each other. But from that day, when we hugged each other and we just broke down in tears, everything changed. And I just thought, right, and we both resolved ourselves that we are going to fight tooth and nail to do whatever we can to get over this. Let's make this an example of the first person that's cured through what we do with motor neuron disease. And we did, and we battled for it. But, unfortunately, that battle didn't work. And all the things that we did were helpful. But eventually there is only still, unfortunately, one outcome with motor neuron disease. And that needs to be resolved. And that's, you know, the battle for that still continues.
He obviously had a great sense of mischief. I want to talk to you about, you know, behind your back, as he was facing into the end game, if you will, he was very keen to, I'm not sure what he was doing with you, but it definitely was a posthumous sense of playfulness that was also important to, with a message, if you like. Tell me what list he was plotting.
Yeah, so as his condition worsened, he realised that he wasn't going to be able to do certain things that he wanted to do. And so he knew that that bucket list would never be complete. He wouldn't be able to do his bucket list. And that frustration of, you know, not being able to do that then made him realise that what he could do, however, was write that list, but get me to do it on his behalf once he did pass away. And so then he spent over a period of about 2 years compiling this list of things that he would have loved to have done. Mike was an adrenaline junkie, you know, he was a semi-pro paintballer, did everything, snowboarding, wakeboarding, he did the lot. I never did that sort of stuff. I would absolutely shy away from it. Prefer gardening.
Yeah.
You know.
yeah, I relate to everything you've just said. Go on.
Absolutely. Given a choice, no way. So he wrote that list for a number of reasons. Yeah, he wanted to rib me and have a dig at me, which is what we always did. You know, we're brothers. You do that sort of thing. And there was a certain very mischievous sort of potentially in his head thinking, well, he's never going to get me back on some of these things.
Such as heading to deliver the eulogy to your brother. One of the items on the list said you had to do something on your way up to the pulpit, which was what?
Yeah, that was given to me a couple of days. Didn't know the contents of the list, by the way.
Yes.
Absolutely no idea anything on this. Handed a piece of paper a couple of days before his service from his partner, his girlfriend, Laura. And so walking up to the pulpit, I slammed my foot into the step, fell over, banged my head. Place was packed out with family and friends. Stood up. No one wanted to look at me. The atmosphere was terrible anyway. And at this point, I could just feel people thinking, of all the places to fall over and all the times, how dreadful. And they couldn't look at me. Got my sheet of paper out for my speech, held up another piece of paper, and it said trip over. And that was number one on the bucket list, was to trip over at the most awkward and inappropriate time at his funeral service.
I mean, what a peculiar stunt, but kind of gorgeous. You know, it's like John Cleese at a funeral. You know, you just have to say sometimes it just roll with the offbeat.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
he had you dressed as Gandalf at one point.
Yep, that was so. The location for the bucket list was in New Zealand.
Yes,
You know, arriving at Heathrow Airport, I thought I was just going to check in, fly over to New Zealand, then the list would start. But not as simple as that. So arrive at the airport, representative from Air New Zealand there reads the task out to me, and it dresses Gandalf. Stand at the entry point to the plane and go full Gandalf mode. So I had, actually, Peter Jackson had sent over Ian McKellen's actual Gandalf costume. So I fully dressed up in that, cloak, boots, hat, wig, staff, beard, and I stood there at the plane and, "You shall not pass!" And it was...
So if people were trying to get on the plane, you were Gandalfing.
I was blocking their way.
No.
They loved it. You know, it was... there was really good reactions. You know, a lot of this stuff was sometimes very awkward and very embarrassing, but it was to push me outside my comfort zone. It wasn't just simply to make me look like a fool.
No, but you bungee jumped wearing a tutu. You snowboarded in a leopard print thong and a pink cowboy hat. I mean, that's not in you. This is from the man who just professed to preferring going gardening.
Yeah, I know. But what I did know was I would do whatever was on that list, no matter what. And I would do it in his memory. I would do it. And if I looked like an idiot for a few minutes, so what? The thing that I would always remember in being delivered a task, no matter what it was, you know, wearing a tutu and holding a fairy wand, doing a bungee jump, I did not want to do that. Didn't want to do any of this.
No.
But what I would remember is Mike had no respite for this condition. There would be no switch that he could flick and get a little bit of, you know, normality back to his life. Whereas at the end of every day, and I cared for Mike for those years, I could go home 9 o'clock at night, grab a bite to eat, sleep, recover, and return back to him. There was nothing for that for Mike. So if I have to put myself out of my comfort zone and experience life to its full, then so what if I'm going to be a bit uncomfortable? I mean, it's now a book and it's a film that people can watch, so this discomfort kind of continues.
Yes.
But, you know, it's fine. It raises awareness for motor neuron disease in a nice way, a light-hearted way.
That was Roy Tokian on The Ryan Tuberty Show. Could remote working lead to a drop in wages? Well, Reuters is reporting that the tech giant Google is rolling out a new internal calculator to explain potential pay cuts to employees who choose to work remotely. Now, Philip Boucher-Hayes wanted to find out more, so he spoke to employment expert Peter Cosgrove, Managing Director of FutureWise, and Dr. Laura Bambrick, Head of Social Policy and Employment Affairs at the Irish Congress of Trade Unions.
Well, Peter Cosgrove, that's a great wheeze, isn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, firstly, before we get completely concerned about this, companies will say that they often paid a lot of people different wages based on where they were. So if they're based in a city versus a town, people might get slightly different wages based on standard of living. But I think that's what they're going to try and say. But I think this is slightly more of a dangerous topic because, firstly, it's very emotive. Reality is the place you live is going to have an algorithm, and that's going to be how much you get paid, which probably has some challenges around, you know, where people live in disadvantaged communities. But also it might even start getting people, you know, like we did with people trying to get into certain schools, pretending they lived in certain places so they could get a slightly higher salary. So I think there's a lot for them to work out.
Let's ignore for one moment, if you possibly can, the fact that Google is not a company that needs to be looking to its wage bill, and ask you the question, can there be any reason other than trying to cut your wage bill for doing this?
Honestly, I would say no. They will probably try and say that it's probably all to do with giving people remote working, but actually you can give people remote working at the same pay, and obviously there's lots of challenges with, you know, you often pay for more things when you work remotely than when you're in the office. But I think most employees need to be very aware that this is the beginning of the new way of working. And actually, the new way of working, we have to be very clear that companies are there to make a profit. And the biggest cost you have in any organization, 60 to 70% is generally your people. And this is just the beginning of it. The reality is, if you can do your job 5 days a week remotely, you know, and you work 50 miles from the office, why can't you do it 6,000 miles from the office and be paid 80% less than your current salary? So I always say to everybody right now, don't be very excited if you can work remotely 5 days a week, because as one AI expert said, if you could write a user manual for your job and give it to someone else and they could learn how to do your job in about 30 days, you probably are going to be replaced by a machine. So the key last point I'll make of this is you have to understand the moment you work remotely, you're kind of already making a 3D experience, a 2D experience. So I'd be telling most people that this excitement about remote work is something we should be doing more as a flexible alternative, not a full-time 5 days a week. I think in the long term, there may be other repercussions we don't see. Right.
Back to the basic principle here about a drop in wages. Laura Bambrick in ICTU, when you read this morning, did it turn your hair white?
Well, I suppose to give a bit of comfort to the many remote workers who'll be listening in this morning, this story, as you mentioned, Philip, it originates from the US, where given the sheer size of the country, it is common for companies to have different pay rates across different states. And they are, as Peter mentioned, reflect the different costs of living. And we're seeing the exact same conversation happening in the UK around civil servants' pay. Should they have a reduction if they move to remote working? And that's because the UK civil service pays a London weighting. They pay a top-up allowance that takes into account the higher costs of working in the capital. Now, here's the comfort part. We don't have either. We've neither geographical spans, and it's not common for us to have regional pay premiums. But the main buffer Irish workers have is the protection from employment and contract law. So if you're employer wants to reduce your pay if you're switching to remote working, under contract law, they cannot unilaterally, they cannot single-handedly decide to change your contract of employment. You and your trade union and your employer must agree to that change in terms, including your pay.
I wonder, look, it's only an issue if it's one company or two companies, or sorry, it's only an issue if all companies end up doing this. But while it is just a couple or a handful of companies who are suggesting or proposing this, I wonder, Peter, do you think they might be shooting themselves in the foot? Who wants to work for a company that manages by algorithm rather than by managing by, you know, the human dimension and face-to-face conversation?
You're right, Philip. However, Google would probably argue that their whole business is by algorithms, so they're probably just saying they're being consistent with their core messages. But I do agree with you. The reality is Google obviously don't need to do this given the size, and I think there is a danger. But other companies will potentially follow suit. And one thing that we probably need to consider is if your job has any sort of travel, so let's say you're any sort of a consultant or you work away from home a bit, there's a real issue if you're suddenly getting paid more than somebody else and then you're both asked to travel to the same place for 3 months to run a project. So I think people are going to be very, very wary around this at the start. Laura's 100% right. People can't change their contracts overnight, but there can be issues when they look for pay rises and so forth. And there's always more subtle ways organizations can do things if they need to. So I think the number one thing I would say for these organizations is, you know, be careful right now because we're in a time where people really, really need talent. And actually, you don't want to be an organization where people feel a little bit put off because of policies like this.
Let's ask the question, Laura Bambrick, as we should be of everything at the moment. What are the climate change implications here? Is it right to penalize people for working in a more sustainable fashion? Does that not run very strongly counter to society's larger interests?
Absolutely. This was one of the benefits that have been heralded around remote working, that the environmental, not just the work-life balance, and that it's good for business and communities, that, you know, it is reducing our carbon footprint. But the main thing comes down to wages are determined by the value of what is produced, not on the distance you commute to produce that output. So really, this is a non-starter of a conversation. And it also has to be remembered, the point that Peter made, that, you know, while we do have high unemployment, it's concentrated in those sectors that require a physical presence to do the job, hospitality, retail. So it's still a seller's market for professionals that have been working remotely. And smart employers know that they're going to have to keep workers happy in order to attract and retain staff. So yes, we'll always have rogue employers to do trying this. If they didn't, we'd have no need for trade unions and I'd be out of a job. But I don't think this is going to be as big an issue as it is in other larger countries and countries where regional pay premiums are common.
Indeed, you're going to like one of the texts that's just come in on 51551. So it's not about productivity after all, it's about control. There's a very good solution to these workers, and that is to unionise. Peter?
I'm not against that, but I don't think these multinationals will pay any heed to those sorts of arguments.
Let me ask you the question, though, that is very much one of the themes of the moment, and that is this growing sense that the people who are still in the workplace feel that they are in many instances carrying the can for those who are allowed to work remotely. Whether they are or they aren't working a different workload, I don't know. It's hardly relevant because there is that perception out there. Yeah. So that might be the kind of the thin end of the wedge that allows for workforces to accept this idea that if I'm in the office, I should be paid a premium for that fella who's at home watching box sets.
And there is no question, even though I take your comment there about the box sets, and that was probably the way people used to think about people working from home. Hopefully we now realize that people working from home are working hard. However, the people working from home, even when they say they're working very hard, they often forget that they're not actually a freelancer unless they want to be. If they're part of a company, they're part of a collective. And being part of a collective means all those other things in the office, like training people in and coaching and, you know, supporting interns who decide to join the organization. So there's lots of work that isn't actually part of your core job that also has to be done, building relationships and so forth, you know, filling in for somebody when they're out. All of those things can only happen to people in the office. So I have a worrying view that there's going to be this almost unwritten rule of a two-tier workforce, the people who decide to come back to work and those people who say, oh no, I'll work remotely. And there's this kind of comments going around that said, like, you know, come to work if you want a career, stay at home if you just want a job. And I think companies need to be really, really careful as people move back into the workforce that they're very careful about that dynamic.
Laura, this does, as you say, have to be negotiated. Your rights cannot just be taken away from you. But I wonder, do you not worry that once the genie is out of the bottle, particularly when the idea comes from the world of big tech, that it really is only a matter of time? Now, maybe we're talking about over the course of a decade here or so, before something like this becomes standard practice?
I believe that because we're a small geographical country, that there isn't the ability to introduce geographical differences in pay. We used to, not so long ago, have different rates up in social welfare. You used to have an urban and rural rates of social welfare up until the early 1990s. And it was then recognised that there's swings and roundabouts to living inside and outside city urban areas, that you might get cheaper accommodation, but you have to run two cars. And I can't see that thinking just disappear when we're talking about how we set the wages of workers. I go back to my earlier point that wages are determined on what we produce, not where we are when we're producing it. And that will be true going forward.
Yeah, and Peter, one final point here. It's very hard for an employer, isn't it? In the long term, I know they haven't been able to adjust and move out of expensive premises because they have a smaller workforce now in the shorter term. But in the longer term, they will be able to make those kind of savings if they don't have to accommodate as many people on site.
Yeah, and I think we should expect it to happen. I would expect any workforce who are thinking, our future looking, will be thinking, we don't need everybody to work in the office. We can have a hybrid workforce. We can have some people who never come in, some people who want to come in some of the time. And that is actually the way it should work. I think the difference is it has to be something that starts off and it's people's decisions, and people need to go into it with their eyes open so they understand the role. And the reality is, for an employer, if they offer an employee a salary and the salary is accepted by the employee, that's not the problem of the employer if that isn't potentially market rate. You know, the employee has a bit of a job to do here as well to understand what their market rate is.
Employment expert Peter Cosgrove and Dr. Laura Bambrick of ICTU chatting to Philip Boucher-Hayes. Morning Ireland heard the story of two Italian brothers who fell into the sea in Galway Bay 2 years ago and the rescue effort that ensued. Here's Mary Wilson.
2 years ago, Italian brothers Riccardo and Giovanni Zanon were holidaying in Ireland when they fell into the sea at an infamous black spot called the Wormhole off Inishmore in Galway Bay. Emergency services were called and in very rough seas, Rescue 115 and winchman Philip Wren executed a dramatic rescue and saved their lives. Now today, the brothers and their families are back in Ireland to thank the crew of Rescue 115. Riccardo Zanon and winchman Philip Wren, who was recognised for his bravery, both join me. Riccardo, welcome back to Ireland for what we hope is a more peaceful trip this time round.
Hello, good morning. Thank you very much. Yeah, it cannot be worse than last time with the injury, I suppose. So, yeah, happy to be here.
Well, let me take you back to February of 2019. And you and your brother Giovanni were on Inishmore and you fell, I think, about 20 metres into the sea and you were swept out. What are your memories?
Yeah, I just remember this big, huge wave. It was like a big grey wall coming towards me and then it was completely dark. And then I thought, yeah, I'm going to die now in the fall. And then luckily, I mean, when I got up and I saw I wasn't dead, I was a bit surprised. And then it was a lot of like being dragged around by waves. And then at last, we saw a person, another tourist who called the Coast Guard, and then I remember this helicopter and then Phil coming down. And then when I saw him, I had the feeling, all right, this is going to be okay. We're going to get out of here. And then it was like that, although I got injured, but I mean, we made it and it wasn't that easy.
Philip Wren is with us as well. Philip, you were the winchman on the day. Will you describe getting to the scene? This is a notorious spot.
Good morning. Yeah, it is. I've been to it a couple of times, a couple of different instances, one similar to the guys and another one where someone was injured themselves just walking across the rough area of the rocks there. So yeah, Poulnabesht is on the western side of Inishmore. It's like a natural swimming pool shape that's cut out of the rock from erosion. And there's quite high cliffs around, but there is a phenomenon on the west coast there where there's kind of a bigger than average wave hits every 7 or 8 wave, and that's more or less what came in and hit the lads and knocked them off the cliff there down into the wormhole. And I suppose while we were down there, while I was treating the guys, another wave came in and hit us all there. Kind of upset the scene there.
Were you all washed back out to sea at one stage before being brought back in again?
No. When we got on scene, I started treating Ricardo as he had the most serious injury. And while I was trying to get him onto a spinal board, we call it a combi board, the wave came in and hit us, but it threw us all forward, threw us all under the water. And I had to try and hold Ricardo under the water. With the shape of the rocks and the land that is there, the water then swept around and tried to sweep us back out again. So again, I was holding Ricardo under the water. It tried to sweep us out, but lucky enough, we weren't.
Ricardo, how badly injured were you?
Well, when I fell with one leg, so I broke my tibia, and basically 8 centimeters of bone were shattered, so we had to reconstruct them over like 1.5 years with a special external frame. And then I broke my pelvis because the leg was pushed up and it broke the pelvis into points, basically. So I wasn't able to stand up, and I had this sort of wobbly leg. It was like a ragdoll thing, and I was bleeding a lot, so we also had to sort that out later. So probably if I had to wait there for more than what I've waited, then I could have been dead of, you know, like bleeding, so I could bleed to death. But luckily the water was so cold that it sort of stopped the bleeding a little bit, it slowed it a bit down, so...
Worth emphasising again, we're talking about February, aren't we Philip? We're not talking about heatwave conditions in the middle of the summer in Ireland. You have always said this was a team effort with your colleagues on board the helicopter, your winch operator and the two pilots. But you were down there and you had to make, I'm sure, instant decisions about how to get the Ricardo and Giovanni back to safety.
There's a team of 6 with us in CHC. We have 2 engineers back at base as well. So, and I must make a point of note of naming the guys because I haven't done so far. the captain on duty that day was Colin McGrady. The co-pilot of the P2 was Aaron Hyland, and winch operator was Kieran McHugh. Two guys back at base then were Hugo O'Grady and Liam Hannon. So it is a team effort. Definitely a team effort, but. When we're at CHC with the training that we do, you can't get every event. You can't train for every event, but we train quite rigorously and we try our best to foresee what's going to happen and train in scenarios. But as an individual, like we're a team, we're a team effort, but the highly skilled individuals that are within that team, you sometimes then pull out a job like this. But as a winchman, and this would go for every winchman in the country, that when you're on the deck of a boat or you're down on a cliff face like that or up on a mountain, you have to think on the hoof. You have to make decisions, split-second decisions, and that comes from experience. So within CHC, that wealth of experience, for myself, it's 12 years, but there's guys in there with 20 years experience and no amount of money could buy you that, you know.
And that experience saves lives, brave men and women.
Philip Wren and Ricardo Zanon on Morning Ireland. And finally, on today, we found out why men should care about skincare. Dr. Rosemary Coleman, skincare expert, joined Philip Boucher-Hayes with her advice.
How do women and men's skin differ?
Well, the big way men and women's skin differ is because of testosterone. So men really do have thicker skin than women. and their dermis, the lower layer of the skin, is 20% thicker. Hmm. They also have larger and more pores, which means they have more sebum and their skin is oilier. So they have a lower pH, which makes them a bit less sensitive, and the oilier skin makes them less prone to dryness. And a big thing I see is that because of the hair in men's face, I think of it like scaffolding. They have more scaffolding in the lower face, so they don't get the fine lines that women get. They really don't get those until they're very old, in their 80s, and they start to lose all the hair, and that's when men and women morph into each other a little bit, don't they?
Indeed. Can we start, though, with the daily aggravation, well, for those who choose to, of shaving and what it does to the skin?
Well, this is one of the few areas in life where women have the advantage over men.
And how we suffer, but we suffer silently.
So silently. Well, the average man has to have about, the average man who shaves, about 15,000 shaves in their lifetime, apparently. So shaving rash and razor bumps are a very common disorder that drive a lot of men mad. And so, if possible, don't shave if you're really suffering, or don't shave too closely. And some men, indeed, probably shouldn't shave. They just get so much trouble with it, and they get scars, etc. But there are very simple tips that dermatologists usually give, which would be very simply, first of all, use a nice, clean, sharp razor, a nice dry razor. Dry it afterwards. Don't store it in the steamy shower like we all do. That will cause a lot less friction in the hair. And try and shave in the direction of the hair. One of my old bosses used to say, shave with one hand in your pocket so that you're not pulling on the skin, which will allow the hair recoil under the skin and give the shaving bumps. And use lots of a gel or a cream. If you're having a lot of trouble with shaving bumps, maybe use an antibacterial gel. King of Shaves is a big hit in our house. And lots of gel, again, will reduce the friction, because shaving is actually like an exfoliation on the skin, and it can really stress and dry out the skin if you don't mind it.
And should you treat different parts of your face differently? Because, you know, a lot of men can have dry cheeks but very oily chins.
Well, that's a very good point, and therefore you should be more careful and gentle on your cheeks, and just, you know, try not to shave quite so closely unless it's that special date, because you will dry them out. And maybe afterwards, one thing I try to do is get men to use a light moisturizer with a sunblock as their aftershave balm. I don't like when they use, you know, heavy alcohol fragrance products that practically smell like the pub after the, to make it manly, aftershave, because that can really dry out and irritate the skin. And it's so hard to get men to put any cream on their skin or a sunblock that I find that that's an opportunity if you can get them to do it then.
Why do we need the SPF, Rosemary? Because there'd be plenty of fellows who would say, you know, I'd like to get a little bit of colour in my skin with whatever time I'm able to spend outdoors.
Okay, well, they don't say that around me very much, I needn't tell you. But my skin cancer clinic really has a male dominance. So women really do tend to be better at looking after our skin, and we've really got the message through to young girls in particular. I'm really impressed at the young girls that come into my clinic, even in the teens, who are now using their daily SPF. We have very little protection in our skin, natural sun protection in this part of the world. We're very pale, we have very little melanin, and we still have UVA and UVB all year round. So we're not protected. We have a very high incidence of skin cancer. It's on the rise. Melanoma can kill you. And not only that, it prematurely ages the skin. So whilst I can't appeal to an 18-year-old that they might get skin cancer when they're 70, I can certainly appeal to them for the premature aging. But I'm very impressed that more and more men are starting to take this on board too, because they actually want their skin to look better. That's the impression I'm getting.
Yeah,
in the clinic.
Okay. Now, there's the interesting kind of cultural shift over the course of 20 or 30 years. When you offer that advice on fine lines and wrinkles for men, are they listening now? Because, I mean, previously it would have been obviously something, you know, your fecklessness in these matters would be a badge of pride that you would wear with honour as a man.
Well, you see, it's how you approach them. I wouldn't talk to a man about fine lines and wrinkles, because men traditionally don't get the fine lines women get. Your skin ages differently. Because your skin is thicker, men tend to get aging at a later stage, and they tend to get more sagging and coarse lines. So there's no point in telling a man he won't get fine lines. As you say, lines are you know, quite butch. But what men really don't like in my clinic is red faces. And the sun breaks the blood vessels, particularly of our Celtic skin. So we find that in our laser clinic for red faces and rosacea, the number is, it's not far off 60-40 women to men. And
really?
Not a lot of men, right into their 70s. Will come into us for laser treatment of red faces, where they say it looks like they have a bottle of whiskey in their back pocket, but in fact it's a genetic tendency, it's Celtic skin, and all the weathering, etc., and the sun damage really breaks the blood vessels.
So they can go for laser treatment, but would they be, if they were worried about it, would they be better off just staying out of the sun in the first place?
Well, no, life has to go on. I'd never tell somebody not to go out and do all their activities and not to play their golf every day. We should be able to do everything. We just have to protect our skin while we're doing it.
Do it with a hat on.
No, a hat alone won't be enough. That's fine if you're bald, but that only offers a factor SPF of 4 and a bit of a shadow on your face. An awful lot of sun is reflected off the ground and comes in sideways. So again, men will say, oh, well, I wear a hat playing golf. But they won't wear a hat the rest of the time, and they're bald and their scalp is full of skin cancers. Once they start to get precancerous lesions, I find men are very motivated. Mm. Only very recently, I had a professional sportsman in, and I was very surprised at the amount of sun damage at a very young age. And that hasn't been highlighted yet, that, you know, our sports people, our soccer players, our rugby players, who are outdoors all of their youth, should actually start to wear their sunblock in their 20s when they're training, and not wait till their 40s and 50s when they get their skin cancers.
Now, I had never considered getting a Botox treatment until I heard that it could save me an absolute fortune in buying shirts.
You'll have to explain that one to me.
Oh, I
because
thought that
of sweating, because of hyperhidrosis.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yes.
The Botox injections under the arms.
Oh, yes, we do an awful lot of that.
Do you?
Particularly for men. Oh, yes, it's very good. You see, and again, people will say that they're in a conference or in a meeting and everything is going very well, but they can't take their jacket off because the opponent as such will think that they're really under pressure when they have large sweat circles under the arms. Botox is an extremely effective and cost-effective treatment for sweating, hyperhidrosis. Mm-hmm.
And how long does it last?
On average, a year. Some people will get slightly shorter. Other people will get a year and a half. The average is a year, maybe, you know, 9 to 12 months.
Yeah, and a vastly, vastly reduced bill for the shirts as well.
Totally.
What other treatments are men coming to you for that they wouldn't have been 15, 20 years ago?
Okay, well, first of all, men really are asking time and time again now about the proper skincare products to use, which is interesting. And the important thing is they must be invisible, they must be very matte, because men's skin is oilier. They don't want, you must never give them, well, this is a generalization, but in my experience, men don't want to look white or shiny. The more invisible the moisturizer with sunblock, the more likely they'll use it. And that would be the main thing. And then cosmetically, again, the treatments must be invisible. We do an awful lot of laser for acne scarring. A lot of men in the 40s will find that old acne scars, as the collagen reduces with aging, the old acne scars become visible and they don't like the skin looking rougher. And men also like the treatments Cool Sculpt for the love handles and the belly as a lovely invisible sheet.
What's that?
That is an extremely successful and permanent treatment for fat reduction, cryolipolysis. Men love that.
Okay.
They also like.
Sorry, I've never heard of this. I mean, how does it differ from liposuction?
Oh, it's completely different. It's totally non-invasive. It will take about 45 minutes. It's relatively painless. Once the skin gets cold, it's not particularly painful. There's no anaesthetic. There are no needles. You're in, you're out. And then over the following 4 to 12 weeks, the fat melts away in the particular area, if they're suitable. They
really
like that.
That was Dr. Rosemary Coleman chatting to Philip Boucher-Hayes. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of Playback Daily. We're back again at the same time tomorrow. So from me, Louise Herity, cheers for listening and take care.